Fire in the hole.
Captains Lewis and Clark reached the headwaters of the Missouri River in 1805. For about 1,000 river miles, they hadn't seen a soul. Until the Shoshone found them in the Rockies and gave them horses for their trip through the mountains. On the other side, the Nez Perce gave them food, probably saved the expedition from starving to death. After that, they'd meet native peoples almost every day. I'm Barrett Golding of Hearing Voices from NPR. A few summers back, my friend Joseph Verbanek and I bicycled that same route from the mountains to the ocean, and like Lewis and Clark, we talked to people along the way. One morning, on the Locksaw River, we ran into about 40 members of the Blackfeet Nation. They were getting ready for work.
Bob said he seen two fires start on Maple Ridge last night. Flared up.
This is Blackfeet 39. We're wildland firefighters from Blackfeet Reservation, Montana. Some years we have over 100 dispatches just to Blackfeet. We manned the most firefighters in probably the United States. 20 to 30 crews at once. I was up here last year in Idaho, and I think we hit like 8 fires in 10 days, and every fire is different, and you have to think about your escape route, your safety zones, and trees falling down, so you can't hear them when they fall. The only time you hear them is when they hit the ground. And then you got to think about the drought conditions, and when it's dry, it's just like pouring gasoline on a piece of wood and lighting it so fast it'll like ignite.
How long have you been doing this?
About 18, 19 years.
It's in your blood.
We just grew up with it, most of our...
Smoke.
Our dads mostly all did it, you know, when they were young. It's a kind of a pride thing with the Blackfeet. We take pride in trying to be the best firefighters in, you know, nation, and probably the world, too. Yeah. I'd say the world, huh?
Yeah. Smoke gets in your blood.
She's a hot shot.
What's that?
She's a hot shot. Ask her.
What's a hot shot?
Hot shot's like...
Best is the best.
Yeah, kind of like the Marines of the firefighters. They're the first ones to go there and the last ones leave mostly. So you see a lot of action and it's scary, but you know, you get used to it. You kind of like that rush it gives you. Getting chased by the fire and almost getting hit with a bunch of trees and... Yeah, we had a couple close calls, and you know, we were back burning down this mountain, and then a fire was coming up that creates its own wind, so it blew up in our face and come up after us, and we were watching it make sure it wouldn't jump the line, and here it did, and it just sounds like a jet taking off, that's how it sounds. Well, we got into our vehicles, and we headed out a little bit further down the road, and watched it blow up a little bit, and then we're right back in there trying to put it back out, because there were houses down below. So we have to watch that. You know, it's fun. Gets lots of money, a lot of problem solving. It's hard work. You stay away from your family a long time, and you kind of miss them. And you ride them all so often. And, yeah, I love it.
We burn all that left.
Well, I was giving them get some.
Mind if I grab your rig real quick?
Go ahead.
I'll bring it right back up. Yeah, I just got to run this down.
Yeah,
thanks. No problem.
Yes, I'm Sister Mary Kay Henry here at the Monastery of St. Gertrude in Cottonwood, Idaho, at the foot of a wonderfully wooded butte here on Camas Prairie, which is originally part of the Nez Perce lands. People can experience the draw of the land. They can look over and see the Seven Devils Mountains, the beginning of the Salmon River breaks, look out across Camas Prairie to the Bitterroot, the Clearwater Mountains. We're going to go into the chapel here at St. Gertrude's where the sisters are going to be celebrating the Eucharist.
feels good. Sun feels good.
Well, I'm Sister Carol Ann, and my focal point is the woods. Supervising of the harvesting, the logging, it's the basic managing of it.
I'm Sister Janet, and I use the herbs that we grow to help make tinctures and salves, healing potions.
Well, caring for the earth, I think, is an essential part of who we are. That's our faith. We're part of creation. We're not separate from it. And so it doesn't do any good to help people get born or help people have money or whatever you're doing if what we're giving them is a sick planet to live on. I think nature is the original scripture that tells us about God.
To me, it's also like a mirror of God. It reflects God. You look at nature and you see God, too.
It, Catholic spirituality is very much the awareness of the sacred in the everyday.
Stones that the building's made out of came from the hillside. So it was all quarried from the hill, brought down by horse and wagon, and the sisters helped stack them up. So we talk about, you know, the house we live in comes from the earth, the food we eat comes from the earth, and then our cemetery is up just above the rise there, and then we go back to the earth.
Good morning. Tots may we. Tots may we. Daytime is tots halachp. It sounds a little hard. Halachp. And then evening or nighttime is kulawit. Tots kulawit. Tots means good. Tots. Everything that's good. And when you say bad, it's kapsis. Kapsis. Even just the word sounds like it's bad. You know? That's the way a Nez Perce language is. Huh? So here I am. I've been a leader of our spirituality here for about 25 years or more. And a lot of people call it religion, but I term it as our way of life, because that's the way our people lived a long time ago, and so we're trying to keep it going. I do a lot of reburials and funerals and weddings and things like that, the old Nez Perce way. Mostly the reburials, when people are surfaced to the ground with erosion and construction. And so we have to rebury the bones. And so I guess I'm the only elder now that really can speak the language fluently. That's because I grew up with my grandmother, and she never did learn how to read, write, or speak English. So I teach my grandchildren and my relatives about all the ways that our people had and try to speak the language. That's who we are. Our identity. Inin wanik to us is lumps. Ki wanik tipatneya kakao witsaya kinawatispa. He was in him. Identify myself and this land where I live is my homeland. To me, it's like my sacred home. All the water that flows from different rivers and springs is like the blood veins we have in our bodies. Without blood veins, we couldn't live, and without water, we couldn't live. So, I don't know. People building homes along the river and they polluting the river, and I don't know. It's just some things I look at a different way. And they use all these chemicals to kill weeds and everything, and all that in time comes into the rivers and the water and into the earth, and then they dig wells on top of that. Got two rivers, one here and one over there. We have a water shortage. Unbelievable. So, I don't know, it's just the way I look at life. It's just a battle all the way.
Horace Axtell. He's the subject of the book, A Little Bit of Wisdom, Conversations with a Nez Perce Elder. You are hearing voices along the Lewis and Clark Trail, down the Columbia River from the Rockies to the Pacific. We've crossed from Idaho into Washington. The town of Patterson is pretty small, but it does have a cafe. That's where we met Lois and Betty.
Well, it's just a wide spot in the road. If you blink, you miss it. This is a farming community, a lot of rich people here. They all have a new pickup every year and live in great big houses. I was postmaster here for 30 years, and I retired 14 years ago. So I've been around a while.
In fact, the post office used to be right in this corner. There was a little post office, and she run the post office and the little store.
It's just kind of the gathering place for the whole area. I don't
usually
know.
Usually every morning there's several in here, gathers for coffee, you know, and the farmers, they chit-chat. They do their farming in here and drinking coffee, and we do our BSing and drinking coffee.
So. Yep. I raised my two boys here, and one of them came back, and he raised two of his here. So it's just been our home. Oh, I think about now going to a... What is it I want to go to? Assisted living. So one of the neighbors has got her father-in-law in one. She took me over there here so I could look it over and see what I thought. And I said, my God, all these old people, I can't come here. So that was the end of that deal. Oh, I couldn't stand that. They're just the saddest people, and nobody ever smiles. But maybe if I went, I could jar them loose and they could have some fun. I don't know. I'm not married. I wore two out. They're in the ground. Oh, my. I'm 77. I'll be 78 in December. God, I'm almost 100 years old, for God's sake. I didn't know people even lived this long.
Sitting under a bridge along the river are four generations of Lewis Butler's family. He used to work at the nearby Hanford Nuclear Reservation, which produced plutonium for bombs.
I'm Lewis Butler from Yakima. That's my daughter, Peggy. She's from Yakima. And I got my other granddaughters up there, and her daughter's up there in the car. They're fixing to come back down. And this is my little grandson, Caleb. And we're trying to catch a few catfish. Caught two. They're right there on the stringer if you want to see them. I'm retired. I retired from Hanford. Yeah. Everything worked around radiation, and whatever they wanted me to do. It was just a pretty nice bunch of people to work with. It wasn't a bad job. A lot of times we had to get down and lay down a ditch and dig ditches around the pipes that had radiation in it, but they put lead on it to try to bring it down to as normal as they could. They were pretty, safety up there. There's a good bunch of people. Now that stuff's potent. When they'd open them big leads, wind would blow and get some of it out. Then we'd go around and gather up the tumbling weeds, the pitchfork and gloves on and everything. Then we'd pile them up and burn them. And the ashes were just as strong after you'd burn them as it was before. They dressed as good as they could. We'd dress each other. We'd wear two pair of gloves and two suits of clothes and everything. And sometimes we'd have to wear a mask if we was in a zone that was pretty hot. I don't talk about too much what they make, you know, kind of a secret, and that's about all I know. Yeah, we're trying to enjoy ourselves, and she works all the time, and I help take care of the house and outside and help the rest of my kids. Yeah.
There's four generations right here.
Yeah, when we leave, you won't see no paper, nothing laying around here like you do in a lot of places. Most of the people is trying to clean up and everything, but there's a lot of them that goes fishing and leaves more junk than they take. But we don't, and we're trying to teach the little ones to be the same way, where they'll have something when they get big.
Oh, baby. Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, she got one.
Hey, that's a nice baby.
We're standing at a ledge right now at the edge of the river, basically a basalt wall, and we're looking down about 30 feet at the river's edge. There's a big bend in the river here, and we're about to enter the Columbia River Gorge. There are dams built all the way up the Columbia, and many of the Lewis and Clark campsites will be underwater here. But even beyond the Lewis and Clark campsites, Lewis and Clark, if you look at the maps, they're mapping village after village after village up and down the river here. All of those villages have been flooded as well. Any sacred place that they may have seen, and they saw burial sites, those have been flooded. Almost everyone who's thinking about Lewis and Clark always think about the aspect of trade. They can be trading knives, they can be trading beads. As they're coming back up the Columbia River, they're trading skins. Lewis and Clark are trading skins for beads. They're getting beads from the Indians, which the next day they may trade for dogs, which they'll use as food. On the Missouri, they could get firewood because of the cottonwoods alongside the Missouri River. Here, they had to buy firewood. Now, that's a shocker. I mean, you think of Lewis and Clark as guys who are out exploring the wilderness. But on the Columbia, they are with a different group of people almost every night that they are out here. When Lewis and Clark passed down this river, there were 23 native languages being used. Today there are two. The challenge is, can we keep those two? And is there any way that we can recover any of those other 21 that have been lost? Languages that they recorded then, 200 years ago, we can't today because they've disappeared.
Archaeologist Ken Karsminski talked to us at the Columbia Gorge near the Dalles Dam. You are hearing voices. When Lewis and Clark arrived at the ocean, they'd hoped to find some trading vessels there and catch a ride back home. No dice, though. They'd be walking. So they called the place Cape Disappointment. That's still its name. It's a Coast Guard station. It sits right where the Columbia enters the Great Western Ocean. That's what Captain Clark called it. Quote, "For I cannot say Pacific Ocean, as I have not seen one Pacific day. Its waters are foaming and perpetually break with immense waves on the rocky coasts, tempestuous and horrible." Nowadays, the place is known as the Graveyard of the Pacific. People like surfman Executive Petty Officer Kyle Betts of the U.S. Coast Guard are constantly on call.
Beep.
We're designed for the worst that Mother Nature can throw at us, and that's when we go out. This is about the worst you're going to get on the West Coast. You got to figure almost all the Pacific Northwest drains through the Columbia River, meeting those waves that could come from the Sea of Japan or even as far as Alaska. And when it meets this big flow of water coming out, that just builds up the waves up to 30, 40 feet in height. There's even recorded instances of 50 feet of wave coming in across this bar. And it can get pretty nasty out here. The waves, they make a tremendous sound, like freight trains rolling in through the bar. You can hear them coming. You don't see them because most of the time it's in the middle of the night you're out there and the wind's blowing about 50 to 75 knots and the rain piercing your skin and breaks from every direction coming at you. To give you an idea what it can be like in there is lift a lid on your washing machine. And standing in a 40,000-pound boat straight up, and then you're falling 20 feet free-falling. You just feel yourself falling down the backside, and you can't see nothing, and the froth is blowing all over. And then you got kids, 18, 19 years old, stand behind you, and their eyes are the size of saucers, wondering what you do. What do we do? What do we do? And I say, well, when you feel the boat stand straight up, bend your knees. It's a long ways down. That's basically all you can tell them. You see kids mature real fast. You know, they get here, they're 18, right out of high school. They're still talking about the prom dance. And the next thing you know, you're out there in these big waves, pulling people out of the water and saving their lives. You see people in the water, and you have to make that decision, can I get in here and do this? When the waves are big and the wind is big, and you know you're going to put $1 million worth of boat and five lives at risk to save one. And when you go in there and you pull that life out of the water and you get them out and you get out safely, there's no greater thrill. They could give me any award they want to. When you turn to that person, they say thank you. That's the biggest reward you could ever get. I don't care what kind of medal they pin on me for that.
Well, we made it. From the mountains to the ocean, by bicycle. Coming up, we do it all over again. That's in a minute on Hearing Voices.
From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
I'm Barrett Golding of Hearing Voices, and I admit it, I'm addicted to bike tripping. I've pedaled from the Rockies to the Pacific not once, but twice. The first time was in the 90s with my friend Larry Massett. He produced this program, On the Trail of Lewis and Clark, for the public radio series Soundprint.
On July 12, in the evening, we came off the Lolo Trail down from the Bitterroot Mountains and onto the prairie in Idaho. We saw two little kids riding their bikes around and asked them where we were. Cricket Creek, they said. Where's that? They thought it over. And they said, we don't know.
A great city of 120,000 persons who cannot tell their right hand from their left. Should I not have pity on their cattle?
Devilry!
Thus was God's and love forward. Made known to man.
Keith,
get on the other side of me.
They took us back to the trailer where they lived, and their dad said we should spend the night, and we wound up with the kids on the couch watching Bible cartoon videos.
Rocky.
Barrett and I volunteered to go to sleep right there on the floor as an example to everyone, but their dad wanted company too. As soon as he could, he broke out the beer and switched the TV over to something with guns and cars and began to reminisce. He was a logger, And the trouble was, while he was out cutting down trees, his wife had run away with a church that plants trees.
Some tree planters moved in here a year ago, right next door here. They send these tree planters all over the United States, and for every tree that they plant, you know, they're saving a soul. And these, they work, you know, 16, 20 hours a day. And I don't know, they, just a day or two before they left, they came up and gave her the big religious spiel, you know, and they just kept giving her the, calling her, you know, writing her letters, sending her information, you know, like the Pope's secret and all those tracts, you know, from the church. And she must have been looking for something, you know. And I thought,
yeah, everything he said reminded us of food. We'd eaten dinner now, but up in the mountains we had run out. When we finished the Lolo Trail, we had a bag of powdered milk left and a potato. Lewis and Clark ran out of food and in the Bitterroots, too. They hardly wrote about anything in the mountains except how steep the trail was and food. They began to eat their horses. Also, Captain Lewis had a trick dog, a big black Newfoundland, whom he had trained to impress the Indians. I can't find any reference to that dog after they crossed the mountains.
That's what induces mind control, you know, is lack of protein and lots of carbohydrates and lack of sleep and, you know, the constant, just constantly working on your head, you know. I mean, she thought that literature was, you know, like those tracks, she thought that was, you know, pretty phony too, you know, the first time we read it here. But now, you know, these people believe that, you know, it tells in there that the Pope is a homosexual, and my attorney right in the trial, he'd get up and ask those people, say, well, do you believe the Pope is a homosexual? And they'd say, yes, I do. It's amazing. You know, they keep them on a low-protein, high-carbohydrate diet. And really, most of them are basically, you know, they probably wouldn't know if Christ was crucified or died in a dog sled race, you know.
I crawled outside and tried to get some sleep in the backyard, still thinking about food and mountains. Mountains are fine till you get hungry and get lost a couple of times, but they weren't supposed to be there at all in 1805. Lewis and Clark were trying to find a water route so you could sail across the country. Without a river, there was no way to haul freight and do business. They were figuring on a one-day portage, maybe 20 miles. Captain Clark later fine-tuned that figure to about 220 miles. And some of the miles are steep to where your horse or your bicycle will tip over backwards if you aren't careful and slide down again. Too bad. The next morning, we went to see Eva Wolf, who's sort of the town historian of Weipe, Idaho. She was born in a cabin on the Lolo, lives now in a big old house in town full of her memories and other people's, with old photographs, Aladdin lamps, an old church organ that you pump with your foot.
Didn't you ever see one of these? One long, two short. Get your neighbor so you know what's going on. They're going to be a dance on Saturday night, or they're going to have a quilling bee on Friday afternoon, or they're going to, somebody had a new baby, or a horse died, or a cow needed help. Why, you know? And then somebody else might get on the line because it was a party line.
Lewis and Clark, she said, came right through Weipe, but there were no settlers following behind them. The town grew up much later on account of a gold rush and then a logging boom in the 1920s.
At one time, we had a much larger business area than what we have now. We had three restaurants here, a drugstore, and a theater, and we had even had a newspaper. But I am great for betterment of our community. I would like to return it to a Western theme. I would like to have watering troughs put on the main street and hitching racks. And I would like to see some of our buildings with false fronts. And when I brought it up, our city council and the people in town were about, if I hadn't been an old timer, they would run me out. How dare you mention that? We can hardly exist in what we're doing. Well, I know it's been hard. It's been very hard. But I think that is our only solution. Everyone knows it's part of the Lewis Clark stopover, and it couldn't be like Leavenworth, Washington. They made over their town, and they did it in Swiss Chalet. But I don't think that would work here at all. We have the mountains up above there, but not right here. I thought at one time when I was quite young that I would really, this was a hicky town. I thought it was hicky, and I would like to get away from it. But I didn't. And I shan't.
From Weipe, the route drops west to the Clearwater River. It's a good bike road, smooth downhill. No problems except the logging trucks. A little downstream from Orofino, Lewis and Clark stopped to build canoes and get back on the water. We stopped to talk to a retired Forest Service engineer named Ralph Space. He told us that the route we had used across the mountains was one he mapped in the 1920s for a fire road. The old Nez Perce route, which Lewis and Clark took, was a lot worse, he said, and besides, it was lost now.
I had never read about Captain Lewis and Clark. I knew they'd been through there, and that's all. And I didn't pay much attention to it. I did run onto parts of that old trail, and I asked some fellows there what that old parts of that was. Oh, they said somebody's either had a trap line here, or they've had a fire here sometime or another, and they used that trail. But I think I could have, when I was younger, if I'd tried to, I could have followed it through.
To atone, perhaps, for losing the Lewis and Clark route, Mr. Space was saving an old mayonnaise jar full of dried camas bulbs. The camas looks like small black onions, petrified, with an aggressive odor.
This is some of it, after it's dry. Now, I've had this. Well, let's see. Mrs. Wilson, old Indian, she's dead now, gave me this, some of this camas, I don't know, about, well, at least 10 years ago. You see, it never changes. I've chewed up just one of them to see what it tasted like. I've never tried to make any bread or anything like that out of it. Mrs. Wilson, she used to go up to Musselshell Meadows. You know where Musselshell Meadows are?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Indians dig camas at Musselshell Meadows. They still do.
They do.
The Weipe Prairie, of course, is all settled up and farmed, and they cut them off on that, but it covered about 1,000 acres. It was a place where the Indians from all over this country went to dig camas.
Now, I read someplace or heard that one of the early arguments between the white settlers and the Indians was that the settlers wanted to dig up those camas fields and get them out of the way and plant something better in there.
Well, they did. The Indians regretted very much to see the Weipe Prairie plowed up. I think it won't be many years before the Indians won't dig camas anyhow. They're becoming pretty much modernized. Most of them cannot speak the
the Nez Perce language anymore. It'll soon be a dead language. Yeah, and they're working out among the other people scattered out. I don't know of a single purebred Nez Perce Indian anymore. I suppose in another couple of hundred years they'll be gone.
A few days later, we met a Nez Perce woman in a state park near Lewiston. She was wearing a leopard skin bathing suit and eating a hot dog. We met a schoolteacher bicycling across the country by herself for the fifth time. Back home, she said, she had three grown kids, husband, dog, and middle-aged friends. And the only trouble she'd ever had was once in Yellowstone when a grizzly bear stepped on her trying to get to the garbage dump. At a campground near Wallula, we met an old man living in a ragged Ford bus. He was trying to make toast on a propane stove.
There ain't no work anymore. I've been in 13 states in the last 4 years. Every place you go, there's businesses, you know, are just closing up. Like that town where I'm from, 25 years ago, there was 5 hotels there, and now every one of them's closed. There ain't a hotel in town. I know a guy up there, 78 years old, and he's talking about going, I guess he's going to go bankruptcy. Been farming all his life.
Did you ever farm? Did you ever catch
farm? Yeah, I used to farm. Born and raised on a farm.
What happened to the farm that you were born on?
Well, my brother's got a hold of it. He went bankrupt here a year ago, I guess. The bank took all his cows. And the little town of Kuski up here has got 50 empty houses sitting in it. Government owns them, I guess. Sawmill closed up, you know, everybody's leaves. Insurance companies, I suppose, will end up with the land and the banks. I don't know what they're going to do with it. Trying to get everybody into the big cities. I guess what they're doing. I always knew this was going to happen, you know.
When we hit the gorges of the Columbia River, wind picked up and stayed up and got stronger. Lewis and Clark didn't bother about wind much in here. They were down in the water, getting knocked through the rapids. Up on the Oregon bank on 84 with the logging trucks on August 2, 1987, around 10 a.m. near the town of Mount Hood, Barrett and I clocked ourselves at 1 3/4 miles an hour. At last, we had achieved a rate of travel slower than Lewis and Clark.
I mean, this is like the windsurfing capital of the world now.
This, where?
Yeah, here, Hood River, the gorge. Everybody around the world knows at this place. Every pro, every famous person you can imagine was here yesterday. Robbie Nash and Rhonda Smith, Maui Meyer, I mean, they were, Mike Waltz, they were all here. It was really neat.
Didn't you hear about the winds in here in the gorge?
Well, not really.
This is nothing. It gets really blowing.
This wind has been killing us, and you're telling us it gets worse, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, this is nothing. 50 knots. You're going to be riding along, and 50 knots is going to hit you right in the face. It's going to be hated. These are some of the biggest headwinds in the country.
What's the town like?
Oh, it's fun. It's a neat little town. It really is. It's with all the windsurfing people here, I don't know what it would be like without. It'd be kind of, you know, just the loggers. I think that's all that's here.
On the town beach, where the wind was down a bit, we talked to a logger. Whenever we could, we were talking to loggers because we were trying to figure out whether they hated bicycles or just didn't see them up on the road. This man, like Captain Lewis, had a trick dog.
Come here. Sit down. He can spell, but you got to leave some letters out. Like C-O, Willie. C-O-O-K-E. That's supposed to be Cookie. C-O-O-K-E? Huh?
He won't do it if you say C-O-O-K-I-E.
I don't know. We've always just left the I out. The Cookie? We ain't got none.
What are these guys like, these surfer guys like?
I don't know. I've never talked to any of them. I know one thing, they can't drive. I mean, they just think, I don't know, I guess that they own the road, because when they pull out, they just pull out. They don't look, they don't do nothing.
Is this your hometown? You're born here?
Oh, yeah. I used to work in the woods, but I got bunged up, so I'm on comp now.
Logging?
Well, I was driving a log truck this last time I got hurt.
What happened?
Car pulled out in front of me. I ran over it, squished it flat, killed three people in their car. That was all it was in the car, was three of them, but just like a car compactor. But one thing I didn't think of was the logs hitting the back of the cab. Because when we hit the tree, I thought, at least it's over, and then here come the logs. There was three crashes in that wreck. When I hit the car, when I hit the tree, and then when the logs come through the back of the cab.
By the time we got to Fort Clatsop on the Oregon coast, the wind had dropped off and a cold mist came up. Lewis and Clark hated this place in the winter of 1805. They were wet and bored and cold the whole time. The Park Service has recreated the miserable little fort they built. And they have guys dressed up in buckskin making candles, canoes, scraping elk hides. The two men who were scraping an elk hide turned out to be Lewis and Clark fans and wanted to talk about it. Sure, they told us. The expedition failed because there was no water route and they couldn't find a good way over the mountains. But there was a question of empire, too. If our team hadn't been out nosing around the west, then the English might have been, or the French, or somebody else. Foreigners might have gotten to take all this land away from the Indians.
The Lewis and Clark mission was a covert mission. If we didn't find out about this territory and get knowledge about it quick, in case of war, we knew whatever country would have sucked us into a war, they would have claimed it. That's why the expedition was sent out, because we had to know about this land, we had to claim it, or someone would, and they would use it to push us into the sea. Yeah.
But, you know, I'm wondering why, you know, people like yourselves and me also are interested in this period. What do you think it is that gets us sort of...
Well, I can't speak for this gentleman here, but personally, myself, I think it's a great lifestyle. I could fit very easily into the 1800s, quite comfortably.
I have a lot of admiration for those people, their lifestyles, their outlook on life. They're very tough people. They believed in taking care of themselves. You know, they hunted the animals. They dressed the animals out. They wore the animals. They made their boots, their moccasins. So they were knowledgeable in every aspect of their life that they needed. They knew how to grow crops. And they knew how to do business. They weren't specialists like we have today. You know, a person is a specialist on computers, a specialist in a service-type industry. And he doesn't know very much about the other aspects of life. It kind of gives him a warped view on reality.
Before I came here, I didn't know how to make moccasins. I quickly learned many, many other things, how the various articles of clothing was made. Who knows? Maybe one of these days we might be in a situation where you might need to have that knowledge.
Society was much more defined. You knew exactly where you stood. There was no doubt. There was no less gray area about things.
Chipmunk.
Chipmunk, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you have birds come out there right where you're working. You know, sometimes they've been known to rest on your hand as you're working, as you're cutting up the fat. You know, so they get pretty friendly. Societies are born. They go through a period of struggle, and they, once they get the fruits of their labor, they fall back, and it's a natural cycle, just almost like being lazy. Society gets old, and it's taken over or destroyed from within. It's a predictable cycle, whether you look at this society, whether you look at the Roman society, the Greek society, European society, it's cyclical.
Do you think that we're in sort of one of those late
cyclical phases. You think the country's in a late phase now?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I think people are in kind of a trance. They're asleep. They're walking around with their eyes open, but you know, the lights are on, but no one's home. And sooner or later, they're going to bump into society as a whole, is going to bump into a tree.
We live with illusions. And of how the world is, we think the world is somewhat near as idealistic as we are. We're just babes in the woods.
When I was a kid, I thought Lewis and Clark was about guns and grizzly bears and camping out. Later, I heard it was about business and empire. Still, if you read their journals now, you're struck mostly by what good travelers they were, how competent they were, how they were always waking up someplace new, not knowing what was going to happen next, but eager to find out. If you retrace their route now, the West can often seem old, but the traveling can still be new. You get lost, you stop and look around. You see two little kids riding their bikes. You ask, "Where are we?" And they say, "Cricket Creek." "Where's that?" They say, "We don't know."
On the Trail of Lewis and Clark, narrated and produced by Larry Massett for the public radio series Soundprint. After it aired, we got an email from Stephanie Ambrose Tubbs. She's the author of The Lewis and Clark Companion and the daughter of the late historian Stephen Ambrose. She liked the show, but wanted to tell us the dog semen is mentioned in the journals after they got through the Rockies. So rest easy, animal lovers. No dogs were harmed in the making of that expedition. Well, at least not that dog.
The object of your mission is to explore the Missouri River. In order to determine which course might offer the most direct and practical water route across this continent to the Pacific Ocean. object of your mission is to explore the Missouri River.
The object of your mission
in order
is
to determine which
Missouri River in order
might
to
offer the most direct and practical water across this continent to the Pacific Ocean.
Across this continent to the Pacific Ocean.
This composition is called From the Journals of Lewis and Clark. It's by Dan Buckvich and performed by the Great Falls Symphony and Choir. Speaking from the studios of Peak Recording in Bozeman, Montana, I'm Barrett Golding, and there's lots of Lewis and Clark links at our website, hearingvoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of SoundImagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.